welcome to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition where we lift up voices of activism here in the nation's capital. I'm David Whetstone, sitting in for Esther Aviram, who has prepared a jam-packed show for you. She returns next week. Well, it's countdown to the big rally against fracking in our own backyard. On July 13th, environmentalists from around the region and the nation will gather here in Washington, D.C. to oppose construction of a massive export terminal for liquefied natural gas right here in the DMV at Cove Point, Maryland. We'll also take a look at the Freedom 50 events and hear from two area veterans of that historic battle in 1964 against institutionalized white supremacy in the South. But before we get to all that, our headlines. As 2,000 Johns Hopkins hospital workers are preparing to go on strike again tomorrow in Baltimore, newly released tax filings show that Hopkins president Ronald Peterson got a $15.4 million total compensation in the fiscal year 2013. Peterson's base pay jumped to 9.25% last year, but the hospital is telling struggling caregivers to take a 1.5% across-the-board raise in the first year of their new contract. Many of the Hopkins caregivers make so little that they rely on food stamps, Medicaid, and other public assistance to make ends meet. The Hopkins workers, members of 1199 SEIU United Healthcare Workers East, have been bargaining for nearly 4 months for a new contract, but the hospital's latest offer would still leave many relying on public aid. For more information, visit hardship@hopkins.org. Again, hardship@hopkins, one word, .org. Hundreds of low-wage federal contract workers working for 50 companies doing business at federal sites like the National Zoo, the Pentagon, and Union Station walked off their jobs Monday. Led by an army of working women dressed like the iconic Rosie the Riveter, they marched through the Smithsonian National Zoo, where workers are joining the campaign for federal contract workers. As the White House Summit on Working Families gathered this week to discuss the challenges faced by low-wage women workers, a new report revealed that the U.S. government is the largest funder of low-wage jobs for women in the private sector. According to the public policy organization Demos, women work 7 of the 10 low-wage jobs funded by the U.S. government. Joanne Keenan, who works at the National Zoo, was among those who spoke at the rally.
Seven out of 10 of the low-wage jobs funded by Uncle Sam are in fact occupied by women. The U.S. government is the largest employer of low-wage women in the country.
We applaud the president's leadership on raising the minimum wage. But let's be real, 10-10 is not enough to address income inequality, and it's certainly not enough to help working women achieve the American dream.
Right. My name is Joanne Keenan. I'm a contract worker at the National Zoo. I am 61 years old, and I have worked here for nearly 3 years. I make only $9.80 an hour. I live with my sister and husband because I cannot afford to live on my own. I have diabetes, and if I didn't have medical insurance through the state, I couldn't afford my medication. I don't think I can ever afford to retire. This is real. This is my life. I am participating in the strike because I'm asking for the president to fight for women like me, mothers and grandmothers, who are struggling to survive.
Mr. President, I'm struggling to give a better life to my children. I even have a second job to give food to my children, to give a roof to my children. I would like to have and to spend more time with my children, but the only way is to leave one of my jobs. And the other way is to have all the benefits, to have paid days, sick days, vacations, That way I can spend more time with my children. That I can do the homework with them. We need a union. We need somebody who speaks for us.
Women in unions are 36% more likely to receive health insurance through their jobs, and a whopping 53% more likely to participate in an employer-provided retirement plan. Anyone who cares about the well-being of women workers and working families need to care about unions and collective bargaining as well.
I want to thank the President Obama for raising my pay over $10, but it's not enough to support my mom and me. My mother has dialysis and her treatment is very expensive, and I'm struggling to survive and to pay my bills.
It cost me $500 a month to pay for my child care for my son, Emmett. I also pay $250 a month to take the metro to work. After the end a month, I have nothing left.
That's why workers from 50 companies that do business with the U.S. government are on strike today. By allowing federal contract workers to join unions, FDR created the biggest middle class in the history of the world. Today, President Obama has the same opportunity to do that for a new generation of Rosies.
Make Rosie strong! Make Rosie strong! Make Rosie strong!
And those were two voices from this week's rally by federal contract workers, which occurred at the National Zoo. For more information about the campaign, go to goodjobsnation.org. Again, goodjobsnation, one word, .org. Three UN experts on the human right to water and sanitation expressed concern yesterday about reports of widespread water disconnections in Detroit. Disconnection of water services because of failure to pay due to lack of means constitutes a violation of the human right to water and other international human rights, the experts said. The disconnections due to non-payment are only permissible if it can be shown that the resident is able to pay but is not paying. In other words, when there's a genuine inability to pay, human rights simply forbids disconnections, said Katarina D. Albuquerque, an expert on the human right to water and sanitation. The Detroit Water and Sewage Department has been disconnecting water services from households that have not paid bills for 2 months, and it has accelerated the process since early June, with a number of disconnections rising to about 3,000 customers per week. As a result, some 30,000 households are expected to be disconnected from water services over the next few months. And finally, advocates for the unemployed are applauding the introduction of a new bipartisan legislation by Senators Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, and Dean Heller, Republican of Nevada, to restore federal jobless aid for long-term unemployed workers for 5 months. The new proposed legislation comes nearly a month after the initial May 31st expiration date of a Senate-passed bipartisan, fully retroactive five-month extension. That legislation was killed by House Speaker John Boehner when he refused to schedule a vote on it. Nearly 6 months have passed since federal unemployment insurance expired at the end of last December, with more than 3 million Americans having since then been cut from this aid while they still look for work. According to the National Employment Law Project, the resulting hardship and suffering has been severe, including loss of homes, cars, phones, and utilities, the very essentials needed for effective job searches and family survival. And those are our headlines. When we come back, activists say no to making the DMV the capital of fracking. And welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment. It's the On the Ground edition. I'm David Whetstone, sitting in for Esther Avirum, who will return next week. Well, even as the world's leading scientists release new warnings that humans must transition rapidly toward clean energy to prevent climate change, oil and gas corporations are trying to move us in the opposite direction. They want to frack more gas from deep under the earth, but this time to pipe it and compress it through our farms, fields, and neighborhoods to our nation's coastlines, from the Chesapeake Bay to the Gulf of Mexico to the Oregon coast. They are proposing to build more than 20 gas export facilities. These terminals would supercool gas to 260 degrees below zero and then ship the gas overseas to be burned almost entirely in Asia. All at the overall carbon pollution equivalent of coal. This July, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, will be nearing its decision on one such export facility, Cove Point. That's just 50 miles from here in downtown Washington, D.C. And on Sunday, July 13th, there will be the first national rally to say no to the plan for Cove Point and other proposed sites nationwide. Joining me on the line this morning to talk and discuss the Cove Point project and the July 13 rally is Mike Tidwell, Executive Director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and he's an alum of WPFW Airwaves, the former host of Earthbeat. Welcome, Mike. Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back on the air at WPFW.
Well, thank you. Well, fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, occurs by forcing a toxic stew of chemicals into the earth to break up shale rock and then release natural gas, rather. Through the process, it's been linked to air, water, and ground pollution, and even earthquakes. We have bombarded here in Washington, D.C. and nationwide with advertisements touting fracking as clean energy. But what's the truth? Is natural gas clean energy? And what about the liquefied gas that's going to be processed at Cove Point, Mike?
Well, it's sort of like a cigarette. You know, for years and years, the cigarette industry told us that, you know, 9 out of doctors preferred Chesterfields and different kinds of cigarettes. And we thought cigarettes were harmless and they were popular. And then something happened to change all that. And that something was basically evidence, scientific evidence, that cigarettes kill. We had the Surgeon General's report. It's sort of the same with this natural gas. We've been told for years that this is the clean fossil fuel, clean burning, the better environmental choice. This could be the bridge fuel between dirty coal and wind power. This could help us, you know, make that transition. But the reality is evidence is emerging again in this case, showing that actually fracked natural gas is bad for public health and bad for the environment. And it's bad in many ways. One, just the fracking process, which I think most of the listeners have heard about, you know, where you drill down at a mile deep, as you said, underground in places like Pennsylvania, then you drill horizontally another mile, you set off explosives underground, you then pipe down water and chemicals to push the gas up to the surface. That process itself triggers earthquakes, it contaminates groundwater, leads to flammable tap water, and has lots of other environmental consequences. But now the gas industry isn't satisfied with just fracking this gas. In order to raise the price of the gas and to lead to more fracking and more profit for the gas industry, they want to export it, primarily to Asia, to India, China, and Japan. This brings a whole nother source of pollution. You've got to pipe it through states like Maryland and Virginia to get it to the Chesapeake Bay and place called Cove Point in southern Maryland. Then you have to liquefy it. It's a very energy-intensive process. The parent company, Dominion Resources, wants to build a utility-scale power plant just to liquefy the gas. Then you put it on tankers, ship it 6,000 miles to Asia, re-vaporize it, repipe it, and then finally light it on fire for energy in downtown New Delhi or Tokyo. And when you consider the full life cycle impact of the pollution from the drilling all the way to the end use in Asia, it's actually worse than coal for the climate.
Okay.
In other words, we could ask India and Japan to burn their own coal, and that would be better for the climate. So this is a bad idea locally for the environment in America. It's going to raise gas prices here, harm our economy, and it's worse than coal for the atmosphere. So
okay.
It's a bad idea, and we're opposed.
And you've given us a fantastic overview there. So if you could just tell us the liquefaction process of the national, pardon me, I'd said it again, natural gas and being processed at Cove Point, what's the impact there? That would be the first such facility built essentially next to a residential neighborhood. What kind of impact does that kind of project have on a neighborhood like that? And most importantly, how are the residents reacting to the proposed project?
So this Dominion is proposing to build a $3.8 billion, quote-unquote, liquefaction processing plant in a place called Lusby, Maryland, in Calvert County. It's about 50 miles from the White House down in southern Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay. There are liquefaction facilities already built in other countries, in Australia and Algeria, and there are more than 20 proposed for different coastlines elsewhere in the United States, but none of them, the ones already built overseas or proposed in other parts of America, are anything like the one that Dominion Resources is proposing on the Chesapeake Bay in Calvert County. Dominion wants to put it's packing these different industrial processes really close together because they just have a small piece of land there. And it's the only facility of its kind that is near human neighborhoods. There are lots of people who live in southern Calvert County next to this proposed facility. These things are dangerous. They've been known to explode. The one in Algeria exploded in 2004. We've had other natural gas accidents here in America at processing plants across the country just in the last 6 months. So it's inappropriate to build a facility like this near people, yet Dominion is proposing to do that. So the local people are very upset. The assistant chief of the fire department there has resigned over this. He says that this is a situation that poses a explosion and fire risk to surrounding people, and he's resigned over it. So you see a lot of reaction to the safety issue on top of the environmental concerns. And that's why, again, I'll mention that on July 13th, right there on the mall in Washington, D.C., there's going to be a big rally. People are coming up from southern Maryland. They're coming down from Pennsylvania and elsewhere and throughout Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. to protest this facility. And your listeners can learn more at www.stopgasexports.org. And you can register and get all the details. We hope you'll come on July 13th to help us send a message to Congress and to the president. We don't want these frack gas exports in Maryland or anywhere.
Okay. And we'll be sure to mention that contact point again before we let you go, Mike. But you're doing the march. It's on July 13th. It's marching from National Mall to the Federal Regulatory Commission's building. Where's the commission at in this process? And what would those at the rallying be calling on the commission to do?
So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has the final say on these export facilities, and they are getting pretty close to making a final decision. Unfortunately, it's a very secretive commission. It's not transparent. They've refused to hold any official public hearings on this. They've refused to give detailed feedback to comments. The public generated 150,000 comments in opposition to Cove Point, the liquefaction facility proposed in Calvert County. 150,000 comments in opposition, but FERC has not agreed to actually respond to those comments. And so this is a isolated, anti-transparent sort of commission. And that's why we're trying to shed light on them. This week, as we speak, every day at lunchtime, There are picketers outside the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters, and that's on First Street, just about a block from Union Station, right next, ironically, to the CNN studio. In fact, Van Jones, the great CNN commentator and former White House staffer, came by the other day and cheered us on. But all this week, the picketers are outside that office. You can learn more about that. You can join the picket line by visiting stopcovepoint.org. And then everybody's coming back on July 13th. We're going to rally on the Mall next to the Capitol building, and then we're going to march to the FERC headquarters. It's about a one-mile walk. It's going to take us, you know, 30, 45 minutes to get there. We're going to have drummers, banners, lots of music. So we're going to march, and we're going to shed light on the wrongdoing at FERC.
Okay. You know, something leaped out in your answer just now, that it's, these decisions are being made without being transparent, done in isolation and secrecy. Many people are concerned about this. So if we could, what's like the scope of this project? Last month, members of the SANE Energy Project told us that Cove Point is just the end point of a larger plan to build massive pipelines up and down the East Coast, and that they would end at Cove Point. Are these pipelines being built, and how are these projects leading to Cove Point affecting our environment?
Well, it is going to take an enormous infrastructure to get this gas from deep underneath the ground throughout the Appalachian states of West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, potentially Western Maryland, and as far away as Ohio and New York, to get that gas up from the ground through fracking, and then to pipe it. We're going to need expanded pipelines, new pipelines coming through this region. Every 60 to 70 miles, the gas has to be repressurized, and so you have to build something called a compressor station that uses fossil fuels to operate, and it's very noisy and very pollution-generating to recompress the gas. So you've got, for example, people in Frederick County in Maryland who are fighting a Dominion proposed compressor station. So you've got this whole infrastructure of pipelines and compressor stations. These things leak gas. They're prone to explosions. And then that's how it finally gets to Cove Point, where, again, it has to, they have to build a whole utility-scale power plant just to liquefy it. Then you've got massive tanker ships coming into the bay that transport this liquefied natural gas, which in liquid form is 260 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, also flammable and dangerous. And then imagine, you know, you've got to go all the way across the other side of the planet in these tanker ships. And then the gas is re-vaporized. Mm-hmm. And then, again, more infrastructure in Asia. They've got to build more pipelines and compressor stations in Asia where it's then, again, finally used for energy. So it's a radical idea. It's a radical process.
And Mike, I just, for sake of clarity, I know we're running out of time, but are this infrastructure that you've aptly described, is there actually a go-ahead on the part of these companies? Are we just not aware, given mainstream media's inattention, that the pipelines are being built now, or they're not being built?
Well, FERC is doing something called segmentation. They are segmenting this infrastructure and giving separate approvals for different pipelines and different compressor stations, and acting as if they're not related to Cove Point. And that's one of the reasons why you're likely to see a lawsuit against FERC shortly. Because they need to admit that the compressor station in Frederick County and the expanded pipelines through Baltimore County and all the rest are, in fact, related to Cove Point. It's one environmental impact.
So, listeners, it is affecting Baltimore, Frederick County, and at a neighborhood near you, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. And, again, you can learn more at Stop Cove Point, and you can join the rally by going to stopgasexports.org.
Give us those two contact pieces of information again before we go, Mike. One more time.
Yeah, so we'd really like to invite everyone listening to join us on July 13th. It's a Sunday. We're going to have music for you. We're going to have great speakers and give you a chance to exercise your legs. Learn more about that at stopgasexports.org. And there'll be more information about the whole Cove Point issue on that website. So I would just leave that one website for people to remember.
Okay, thank you. We've been speaking with Mike Tidwell. He's the executive director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and he's also an alumni of WPFW Airwaves, the former host of Earthbeat. Thank you for joining us, Mike, and we'll be continuing our countdown to the big rally in coming weeks, and we'll be on the ground on July 13th. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, looking back and forward at Freedom 50, which marks the occasion of the struggle for human and civil rights in the South. And welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. I'm David Whetstone, sitting in for Esther of Arum. Through Sunday, hundreds are gathering in Jackson, Mississippi for Freedom 50, a look back at the summer of 1964 when hundreds of student civil rights activists took to segregated Mississippi by storm and were met by violence and even death. 50 years ago today, a search was underway for three missing civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, who were found 6 months later, murdered and buried in an earthen dam. In this clip from the documentary Spies of Mississippi, journalists, activists, and the mother of James Chaney discussed the murders and the involvement of Mississippi's taxpayer-funded Sovereignty Commission.
There was a map that can be found in the Sovereignty Commission files today that indicates the direct location of the bodies. It's a hand-drawn map that shows them buried underneath this earthen dam. It is clearly more information that indicates that, again, the Sovereignty Commission knew exactly what had happened, knew where these guys were, and knew that they were dead long before this several-week, multi-month search for their bodies had concluded.
When those bodies were dug up, then suddenly there was no hiding place anymore. There was no hiding place for the Klan anymore. You know, the FBI was getting involved in the case. They were already involved in the case, but they were going to pursue the case. This one was not going to be ignored.
This country could not really reconcile. Why do three young people get killed for trying to register black people to vote, even in Mississippi?
Y'all know what my child was doing. He was trying for us all to make a better living. And he had two fellas from New York. Had their own home and everything. Didn't have nothing to work. But they come here to help us. Did y'all know they come here to help us? They died for us.
And we're back. Pardon me, last week here in D.C., high school students from Macomb, Mississippi, Legacies Project, visited and participated in a history competition. They met two area veterans of Freedom Summer, Dory Ladner and Timothy Jenkins, who spoke to them at an event at the African American Civil War Museum. We'll play that clip.
I started out with Bob Moses in 1962. The first place we went was to Macomb, Mississippi, along with Timothy Jenkins, who's going to speak later. Timothy was a law student from Yale University. And we went down to Macomb to Liberty, Mississippi, to be observed by the Civil Rights Commission for them to have some type of information or incidents that they could use to further our cases along as far as injustice was concerned as it related to voting rights. And I was the only female working with them at the time, and I was in and out of Macomb many a night before day in the morning, and I can remember Reverend Harry Bowie giving me his bed and the clean sheets. I still remember. There are some things that you do remember, and the late Maya Angelou said, how people made you feel, and that's one of the things that was a beauty about going into Macomb. Aside from the danger that we faced and the bombings, I was there in Macomb when Mrs. Quinn's house was bombed, and fortunately no one was killed. Going into Liberty, Mississippi at the dead of night to Miss E.W. Steptoe's house, and many other things that I could stand here and talk all night about. But what I want to say that voting rights came at a price, a price that many of us can't even begin to say. I heard Mr. Lewis Allen telling Bob Moses at the COFO office in 1964 that he was very frightened for his life and he was going to leave Liberty. But Mr. Lewis Allen lost his life around January 20th of 1964 before he was able to get out of Liberty. He was a witness to Mr. Herbert Lee, who was murdered there in Liberty by a state representative. So there are so many incidents, and I was with Mr. Medgar Evers the night he was murdered there in Jackson. Mr. Evers had been a mentor to my sister Joyce and me for many years. We met him when we were about 14 or 15 years old. We were taking NAACP meetings, the state NAACP meetings, by the late Vernon Damer from Hattiesburg, his sister Eileen Beard. And the night Mr. Evers was killed, we had been to a mass meeting. President Kennedy had talked about the Civil Rights Bill. Many things went on. Many lives were sacrificed or lost. But we have a job to do. We will not let the Congress and the Supreme Court stop us from voting. We will not do it. Mrs. Hamer was in the cotton field. We were there in Indianola when she was kicked off the plantation in 1962. So we cannot let those things go without answering them. So young people, those of you who are advocating voting, you're doing the right thing, because that's the only way we as a people, we have many people in the Appalachians who can't vote, who can't read and write, but they will come around, they will begin to learn. So what we're advocating is that everybody votes. And so I'm very grateful and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Now we will hear from Mr. Timothy Jenkins.
One of the current myths is that the civil rights movement is over. But if you read the newspapers, you'll see that that's a lie. In the state of North Carolina, they're now enacting legislation that will prevent people from registering before the election. They changed the laws so that people can't register on the day before. It has to be a week before. They've raised other kinds of problems that have affected other states, not just Mississippi, but places like Arizona, places like Utah. You must not think that the struggle of the 60s is over. As long as there are people who want to control power for their personal benefit and for the benefit of their families, for the benefit of their neighbors, for the benefit of the people who look like them, or the people who have the same income that they have, the movement is not over. And one of
the voices that you just heard were that of Dory Ladner and Timothy Jenkins. Both are veterans of the Freedom Summer. Speaking to high school students from Mississippi last week at the African American Civil War Museum. And joining me on the line from the Freedom 50 gathering in Jackson is Najma Nazi Ott. She's the director of the Boston Area Youth Organizers Project. Good morning, Ms. Nazi Ott. How are you?
Good morning. Good evening. I'm sorry, this is not Najma. She had to run, so she passed it over to the two high school students, which is Trey Murphy and Aaron Fink.
Okay, and Trey, that I take it that's you?
Yes.
Okay, and thank you for joining us. So if we could, our time is short. Give me your impressions of what's happening at Freedom 50 and how it relates to your life today.
Yeah, so definitely. So what's happening at Freedom Summer 50th is that Freedom Summer, right now we're discussing, there's still this issue around whose lives matter and what was the quality of life, right? That's what Freedom Summer was about back 50 years ago. It was about whose lives matter, because it was evident that black lives didn't matter here inside of America and the quality of that life here. So so that all trickled down to what we call Freedom Summer back 50 years ago, where civil rights leaders such as Bob Moses and different things, what intended to be a two-week or a few-week project on the Mississippi Project, which is what it originally started out as, transformed into an entire summer, because young people, they was inspired by the young people was inspired by the leaders of the movement to get active and get involved. And so it caused what was first only a few hundred students to come down to Mississippi, transformed into almost 1,000 students traveling from all across the country to come to Mississippi to detoxify the racism that was in Mississippi from the outside. And how that relates to our life today is that it's still a question of whose lives matter and what's the quality of their life, because when it comes to our students, our students aren't really that well. Their voices aren't really heard. And so now we're talking about, do students' lives matter? Because it's clear that we have this perceived notion of our young people that they can't make decisions on their own, or that they're incapable of giving their input in the foundation of decisions being made that affect them. And so it's like, who does their lives matter, and what is the quality of their lives? Because it's evident that it's not that great.
And listeners, you're listening to Community Watch and Comment, the Thursday edition, the On the Ground edition. That was Trey Murphy. He's participating in Freedom 50. His colleague Aaron Fink is along with him. And Mr. Fink, can you tell us what kind of organizing you all are doing today? Because as Trey Murphy was saying, people don't think young people are organizing today. 50 years ago was voting rights and breaking Jim Crow, segregation and white supremacy in the South. How are you organizing, and what are the issues for you today?
Well, the issues for us today are educational rights. And so one way we're organizing around that is the National Student Bill of Rights. It's a nationally recognized list of 15 rights, which are supported by youth organizing groups around the country. And the goal of it is to, you know, get ballots of the National Student Bill of Rights signed, get people on board, and get a federal law, protecting education, free public education for all students in America.
And for both of you gentlemen, what do you take away from your experience at Freedom 50? How might it impact your work back home?
Okay. Well, this is Aaron, and the way it impacts my work is that I think it definitely gives me a new sense of direction, because now I'm able to see that really the Baltimore Algebra Project is part of, you know, of the Freedom Summer movement. It's just a couple generations later. Bob Moses, one of the leaders of the Freedom Summer movement, was able to pass down his knowledge to his daughter, Maisha Moses, who was able to pass down her knowledge to the Baltimore Algebra Project founder, Jay Gillen, and then he's able to pass down his knowledge to us. So really, we are a continuation of the Freedom Summer, and we are still fighting a lot of the same battles that they had to fight then.
All right. And gentlemen, I understand you're still going to be with us. Maybe a final question, and we'll quickly go to our listeners. Is there any particular significance in the Freedom Schools as they relate to education today? We had talked about student debt loan and student protesting of that yesterday on my normal segment. What is the specific significance of Freedom Schools and relating to your cause for education today? Either one of you, please.
Right. Hi, this is Trey Murphy. I think that the major and huge significance of the Freedom Schools is this idea that that we teach our own people, right? So you can go throughout the United States and you can see that knowledge is being passed down from one generation to another, but that doesn't really typically happen too much in the black community, right? And it's because our communities have been disenfranchised for a number of reasons. And so the Freedom Schools are symbolized or a system set up to teach our own people, because nobody can pass down knowledge better than the people who experience the knowledge. And too often we outsource outside of our community. And not saying that that's always a bad thing, but it happens more than it should. And our own people don't teach our own people. And so the Freedom Schools is that mechanism that is set up to say, hey, we can teach our own people and not have to worry about student debt, not have to worry about outside resources coming in and kind of dictating and controlling what takes place inside of our community.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Realizing your own agency, even in youth. Thank you. So when we come back, it'll be your turn, listeners, to call our studio. The number here is 202-588-0893, to comment on the movement for social justice 50 years ago and today. We'll be right back. And we're back. You've just been listening to The Composition Energy by Oye Mika Cole, and it's from her work, from her new album, Life A, which will be featured tomorrow starting at 6:30 at Jazz at Wesley. That's at 5312 Connecticut Avenue. Now it's your turn. Again, listeners, you can call 202-588-0893 to comment on what you've just heard from our guest today. That number again is 202-588-0893. Our student activists, Trey Murphy and Aaron Fink, are still with us, so we'll go ahead and take some calls. Tesfa, if you can hear my voice, I understand you're on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. My question is, here to deny people to vote or to chair. They do all sorts of tricks, from changing the voting district, the congressional district, and all other tricks. But in the third world, and particularly in my country, a political officer and two soldiers or three soldiers will await the voter and check where they drop the ballot. After all this is done, they will shoot people on the forehead and on the chest with Kalashnikov. It's all universal. Voting rights, the struggle for voting rights could be different in different places, but it's all the same. It's about voting rights.
Tesfa, thank you. Pardon the interruption, but in the shortness of time here, this is the world of radio, unfortunately. Gentlemen, Tesfa is a frequent caller who often mentions what's going on in Ethiopia. And you heard his last point. The impingement on voting rights, and particularly stopping and discouraging young people, is a universal thing, sadly, across the globe. Is there some sort of international perspective or motivation to what you two have been doing?
Yes. So definitely that. I think that is a valid statement. I think that one of the biggest things is that when it comes to young people's voices aren't heard. So it's no surprise that this is a universal issue that takes place throughout all of our communities in all of our country. I think that one of the strongest points is that as society today, as we see it, that voting rights is a way of keeping power to the people. And so when you take away voting rights, you inevitably take away that power that people have worked so hard to try to maintain, that levelness to be a part of society and everything like that. And when it comes to young people, they don't want young people to have power. That's very, very real. We're very real and clear about that. And so by taking away their voting rights, you inevitably take away the power. And then it's not just young people. It's also specific communities as well, too, right? And so those communities had been stripped from them. And that is the reason why this thing is not just a U.S. thing, but it's a universal thing. But let's be very clear that U.S. right now is the 5% that leads to 95% of the world. And so when the U.S. sets the standard, the rest of the world follow it. So it's no surprise that the U.S. is now doing all of these regulations to prevent people from voting and voting registration, and now the rest of the world are following it, and U.S. is being trickled into other countries.
Listeners, you're listening to Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, which is Thursdays. We just heard from Trey Murphy, and he's one of two student activists who's experiencing Freedom 50. To call on Freedom 50 or the whole notion of youth organizing and taking action in the tradition of Freedom Summer, whether it's the 50 years ago past or what's going on today, call 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. I believe Tahuti's been waiting for us. You're on the air.
Yes, Hotep to you and to your guests and to the PFW listening audience. We have been monstrously betrayed by the politicians and our current leaders. Every one of these people that have made decisions that have caused death and destruction, illness, sickness, and our bleak future for our people should be brought to justice. And if we cannot bring any of these politicians and these other betrayers who have betrayed their leadership to accountability, there is no reason to register and vote. We have to set up our own systems of survival. These people must be brought to accountability. We must protest not only with our mouth, but we must boycott the whole political system. We've got to do something because these people are at war with us, the constituents. They are betraying us. They say everything rosy and beautiful to get our votes, and then they immediately betray us and give us excuses, and we're so dumb we are being registered to vote again in a system that is totally corrupt, and these people are continually eliminating people off the planet and making more.
Tahuti, if you can help me out here just for a moment, I want to just ask the gentleman, you know, these gentlemen are going through training, they're understanding history, and we take your point. I think what we'll take away from that is I'll ask Aaron Fink, are politicians and fellow citizens supportive of your efforts?
No, politicians are not supportive of our efforts. Politicians oppressed youth leadership and youth organizing, and we've seen this all over Baltimore and on a national scale as well. But the Baltimore Algebra Project has to fight constant battles with local politicians, with the National Student Bill of Rights. National politicians are oppressing the youth by being completely unreceptive to, you know, all of our requests. So yeah, it's absolutely true that the current political system is designed to oppress youth, the Black community, minorities. The solution might be having to take control ourselves.
And we have another call. John's been waiting. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to present a win-win reparations plan that I think would be accepted by both whites and blacks. And that is to, for 40 years, create a scholarship account for each descendant of slaves, wherein they would be paid to show up at classes, be paid more for doing well, and be able to earn bonuses for graduation. And it would also allow them to be fined for not going to school. So I just wanted to present that idea to the community and see what you thought.
So, gentlemen, any response to that?
Could you summarize that one last time? I'm sorry, I was here in bits and pieces.
He was bringing in the notion of reparations to the efforts. Do you see your work? Maybe I'm not giving a good summary, but do you see your work as a matter of repair or reparation? Obviously so, but how do you see it?
I think that reparations only work if they're genuine. Especially for the African American community in general, they have not been properly reprimanded for all of the struggles that they had to go through, as opposed to when you look at other communities such as, the Jewish communities and the other communities that have had to endure struggle, similar to what we have had to go through. I think that with reformations, the only thing about that is that even after the time period of reformations, if you don't have a system set up to ensure fair and equal process, then it doesn't mean anything, because all that we know and all that we hold to be true, just, and fair is what we believe in. And so how do we create that sense where we can both be diverse and we can hold on to our own same cultures? Because right now, we can't be both, right? It's either we're going to keep our cultures, or we're going to give up our cultures and be diverse for a larger effort of fitting into somebody else's culture, because if not, we're going to continue to be suppressed and oppressed by a certain group of people. And that's sadly the case for young people all around, right? How do they hold on to their culture, be the young people, be able to grow up as young people, and still be diverse and accepted into society today at the same time?
Listeners, that last voice you heard was Trey Murphy. He's joined by Aaron Fink. They're student activists who are in the Freedom 50 experience. Gentlemen, please be sure to thank Najma Naziat, the director of the Boston Area Youth Organizers Project. And thank you for both of you being with us this morning. That will about come to the conclusion of our show. Since we've been in this transition period here at WPFW, and you've been supporting us and becoming members, I just want to give you also a sense of our programming. This morning you heard, we started the day, of course, with Bobby Hill and music, but Democracy Now! Preceded us and got us to the 9 o'clock hour on the margin with Josephine Reed and Giovanni Russinello, showing how literature relates to culture and activism and jazz and justice. The Collision, Sports and Politics with Eton Thomas and Dave Zirin from 10 to 11. And, of course, in this hour, Community Watch and Comment is the on-the-ground edition with your regular host, Esther Rivera. At 1 o'clock, D.C. Power Talks Hour with Eugene DeWitt-Kinlow and Deborah Simmons. The Empower Hour follows at 2 with Deshauna Spencer. And Mind Talk at 3, our regularly scheduled 5 days a week mental health program with Dr. Pamela Brewer. Coming up next is Chris DeProperty, and don't forget the blues. That will certainly include a blues calendar. We'll go out with the piece Energy. It's from Olayamika Cole from her new album, Leafe. And that'll be featured tomorrow at 6:30 at Jazz at Wesley, 5312 Connecticut Avenue. Thank you again for your listening and your support of your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW. Have a great day. Esther Avirum will return next week. Thank you.